Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio program. I'm your host, Susan Laris and Dans, welcoming you on what is proving to be quite a sunny day here in the Pacific Northwest with signs of spring already emerging all around us. Now, I have to say that it must have been a case of somewhat wicked synchronicity this morning that our returning guest today, Dr. Alan G. Hunter, is going to talk to us about the healing power of the Grimm Brothers tales and of fairy tales in general, specifically related to the Brothers Grimm. But we are going to be talking about fairy tales today. Well, what should happen this morning? There was a story that I encountered just while wandering the web. The exact title of the story, which just came out, quote, "How Frozen Director Jennifer Lee Reinvented the Story of the Snow Queen," unquote. Now, many of us have seen Frozen. It's all the rage. And we're actually not going to talk about Hans Christian Andersen today, which is the originator. Well, I don't know. Maybe Alan can tell us who originated the Snow Queen, because these stories can have many, many origins. But I find it very interesting, because today we are going to be talking about whether we know the true nature of these tales, many of which have really been transformed into disempowering versions by Disney. And this morning as I was wandering the news, I suddenly saw all these stories about Disney and princesses. There was another one this morning, Frozen's Elsa Reveals What's Wrong with Disney Princesses, and it was all about how we're beginning to see that more empowered versions of these princesses are really what we seek, and that we're not looking for our prince in quite the way these princesses have been portrayed to do. So this is so timely, and this is going to be a long introduction if I don't watch it, because there's so much to say about our returning guest, Dr. Alan G. Hunter. He has a PhD in English literature from Oxford University, and he is the author of 12 life-changing books. This is actually somewhat of an anniversary today, because it's been almost exactly a year since he first appeared on this broadcast. He is a very welcome returning guest. This is actually his 10th show here. I had to go out and count. He has written several books, and today we're going to be focusing on Princes, Frogs, and Ugly Sisters, The Healing Power of the Grimm Brothers Tales. Other books that he's written that we have covered on this show include Gratitude and Beyond, Five Insights for a Fulfilled Life, The Synchronicity, Align Yourself with Life's Flow, The Six Archetypes of Love from Innocent to Magician, Spiritual Hunger, Integrating Myth and Ritual into Daily Life, and the last one I'll mention is Stories We Need to Know, Reading Your Life Path in Literature, because today's talk is going to relate to the archetypes that he brings forth and actually are reflected in much of his work and will be today. Alan is a full professor at Curry College in the Boston area. He is an expert in therapeutic writing, and he is also a spiritual counselor who provides one-on-one assistance, and he started his career working with troubled adolescents and also taught prisoners in Massachusetts. And so he brings an inspiring, authentic presence to this work and really brings these tales, whether classic literature or the folk tales that we're going to talk about today, he brings them to life for us all, and in doing so really brings us a true gift and shows us the meaning within these tales and how we can apply them to our everyday lives and our development in life. So what he is bringing to this broadcast is really immeasurable in words, let me say. Now, before I bring him on the line, after this very lengthy introduction, you can learn more about him at alanhunter.net with two L's, alanhunter.net. It's on the show page if you can see it. We do have an open chat room today if you're listening to the live show. We welcome comments on the shows. I always ask for that. If you're listening in the future, I welcome the podcast audience. And please feel free to comment on the broadcast, because I know that Alan Hunter is very responsive to comments that he gets on YouTube and other venues, and I'm sure he would be here as well. So I do invite you to do that. So now I am so very happy to bring on the line, after a year, and this being our 10th show, Dr. Alan G. Hunter. Hello, Alan. Welcome back.
Susan, it's lovely to be on your show again. Thank you so much for inviting me, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
Well, it's always a pleasure to introduce you, although I realized by adding the today's headlines, I was going to make it even longer than usual, because you just have so much work to present. But I couldn't help it. When I saw that, I just laughed, because it's an example of synchronicity. And I think today we're going to be talking about how many of us really don't know the true tales, and we're missing something very important, aren't we, Alan?
Yes, I'm afraid we are. All respect, I suppose, to Disney as entertainment. I was brought up, as many of your listeners probably were, on the Disney stories of Snow White and Cinderella. But we also know from staying sensitive to those issues that those Disney versions, especially for young girls, have proved to be, well, not to put too fine a point on it, they've proved to be crippling. And so that was one of the motivations that sent me back to look at the versions of these tales that the Grimm brothers collected. They didn't write them. They went out as field researchers into what was later to become Germany, but then was a large area of ill-defined small kingdoms. And they talked to storytellers who were working from a long, long tradition of storytelling, because they absolutely knew there was something in these tales that was getting lost, because people were taking them and turning them into popularized versions, which sold lots of copies of books and made people rich, but sometimes strayed quite radically from the tales themselves. So, you know, the Grimm brothers said, no, we need to preserve these. They were serious scholars, you know. They weren't lightweight by any means.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you're certainly following in their tradition by bringing the true tales forward. And there is great value in this. And one of the things you bring out in your book that I feel that is really important is that the insights in these tales, the psychological insights, that are important. And, you know, some of these tales, I must admit, Alan, they're not for the faint of heart. I mean, they can contain some real violence and really led me to reflect upon the times in which they were made. Because, you know, we think our modern-day society is violent, and it is. But then again, you know, there were things you might have witnessed in the Middle Ages and other times in history that would have been even more violent than what we see today. And so I wonder, You know, as we're reflecting on these tales, how do we get to the core meaning, even in the midst of some rather raw material, I guess yeah. I would say, that's very real, well, actually unreal in some ways?
Well, very good question, and I'll reply by telling you about the incident actually that sparked my interest, that grew into the book, and that is I was invited to go and speak to an assembly of women who were asking about the problems with dating and why they couldn't find reasonable people to date. And I thought,
yeah.
Well, this is great. You know, I'll be in this hall with 50, 60, maybe 100 single women. I thought, wow,
that's, <Yes. laughs>
that's every presenter's dream. So I was going to this occasion to discuss dating problems for modern women. And
yeah.
As I was standing around, I was talking to one of the organizers, and she said to me, ah, well, you know how it is, she says. She said, you have to kiss a lot of frogs before you get your prince.
Mm-hmm.
And the other people we were standing with sort of nodded and said, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I said, wait a second. Where did you get that idea? Well, it's the old fairy tale, she said, you know, the old tales of the frog prince. And I said, well, just a second. Can I tell you the real story? And she looked at me and said, well, I guess. And if you go back to the Grimm brothers' story, the one that they carefully selected for being most true, as they felt, to what was really
yeah.
going on, what you discover is that in the Frog King, he's not a prince, he's a king, in the story of the Frog King, as we all know, the princess is out there playing with her golden ball, and it falls down the well, or some people say the spring, and the frog gets it back. And he says, well, I want to be able to sit at table with you, and I want to, you know, sit beside you. And she says yes, but then she reneges on her promise. He goes to the castle and says, you know, you've got a promise to keep to me. And in the usual versions that we are familiar with, mostly because of Disney, what happens is the princess has to kiss the frog.
Yes.
And that's when he turns into a prince. Well, actually a king.
Yes.
You know. So that's what everyone is familiar with, that the princess has to get over her sort of loathing and be humble and kiss this person, and then he becomes a king. And the message behind that is really very damaging, I think. And it says that women have to put up with an awful lot of bad behavior from slimy individuals, and then
yes.
kiss them on the off chance that one of them is going to turn into something good. Now, if you
yes.
go to the actual Grimm tale, it's very, very interesting, because what the frog does is he says to her, you know, I want to eat from your plate, and she says, okay. And he says, I want to sit next to you. She says, well, I suppose I have to do that. And
uh-huh.
then he says, I want to sleep in your bed. And she says, okay. And then he says, I want to sleep as well as you do.
Uh-huh.
And if you won't let me do that, I'm going to tell your father, the king.
Uh-huh.
And that is the point that I think, yeah, and I've tried this on many classes and audiences and workshops, that's the point when people get uncomfortable. This frog
yes.
is behaving like a real, not just a creep, but a sexual predator.
Yes.
And that's the point when the princess, in the original version, she doesn't kiss him. What she does is she is blazingly angry that all of her personal boundaries are being violated. She picks him up and she hurls him against the wall to kill him. Now,
yes.
that's rather different.
That's not in the Disney version.
That's not in the Disney version or in the remake of the Princess and the Frog.
Which is even farther afield. Yes.
Which is even stranger, because they do kiss in that version and they both turn into frogs. But,
yes.
It's all good entertainment. But while we're having fun with the entertainment, we're missing a really important point that the Grimm brothers wished to let us know about, and that is, it's a violent action. The princess is trying to kill the frog. But yeah. That is what allows the frog to turn into the king that he rightly is. And so we don't have to work too hard before we realize, wait a second, what is this telling us? It tells us, I think, it tells us that a lot of women put up with a lot of bad behavior from men. And they do, you know, inadequate boyfriends, boyfriends who can't commit, boyfriends who are parasitic.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I was going to say this is very common. Yes, go ahead.
Well, it's very common. And what happens in the Grimm brothers' tale is that the frog turns into a prince, into a king, only when he is forced to, only when he is thrown against the wall. And you know, it seems to me, as I wander around the world and as I talk with my counseling clients and I talk with my students, it seems to me there are a lot of kings, young men, who could be kings if somebody only insisted that they grow up and take charge of their lives.
But
nobody's insisting. Nobody's insisting. Instead of which, we have, to go right back to the start of this conversation, we have a delightful woman of about 30 who really does believe that she has to debase herself and kiss a lot of frogs on the off chance that one of them will turn up. I said to her, you know, if you want more frogs in your life, you know, keep kissing them because they'll stick around. I said, if you want a real person, a king, someone who is going to be fully in charge, in self-directed, if you want someone who is a real, live, aware person, then you must insist that you get treated properly, because that's what the tale is all about. And that's what causes the, you know, fairy tale happy end. Otherwise, we're stuck with a very sad story of a princess who gives in, who does something she doesn't want to, and then gets, she gets a king to marry. Well, she didn't like him when he was a frog, so how is she going to like him now? But when she challenges him, he grows up, he transforms, and he knows that. Why don't we have more of that available to us? Because the story, the original story, has been overlaid by something softer and gentler that the Grimm brothers never would have countenanced. Now, Disney presumably did what it did because it didn't want to... didn't want people to be cruel to animals or something. But
I would imagine they couldn't have had that in their version. I could see that. What about the anger? You know, something about you know, your write-up of this tale, that the anger when she throws the frog against the wall in that situation was justifiable. And in
Absolutely.
Our culture, in fact, this is something really important to explore. It's definitely true in the spiritual community. Is it ever okay to be angry? That's what this tale reveals. And as I was reflecting upon it, we're told all the time, you know, not to be angry. Actually, we get conflicting messages in the spiritual community. We're told not to be angry, and then we're told if we get sick, that's because of our repressed anger. I've heard that too.
You can't win.
Yes, you can't win. So help us. And in this particular situation, there may be a lot of situations where women are justified in getting angry, and men too in some situations. But I don't know. I mean, help me to explore this, Alan, because I'm working with this too.
Yeah.
And, you know, what do we do with anger?
Yes, well, that's an extremely good question, because there is an answer, and that is these tales, the Grimm brothers' tales, are very short. And so when they deal with a problem, they tend to move between practical advice given in symbolic form, like it's okay to get angry when somebody's misbehaving, and then every so often there will be a deeply spiritual tale of forgiveness and how to keep one's soul in very good shape. I'm thinking of a story that, of course, nobody knows, but it's a powerful story. It's called The Girl Without Hands.
Yeah.
And she is so saintly and so spiritual that she is able to forgive everyone. She's a wonderful, wonderful role model to us, perhaps. But remember, you know, the year was around 1800 when the Grimm brothers were out there collecting these stories, and they also knew that most of us had to deal with ordinary things like friends, neighbors, lovers behaving badly.
Yes.
And that a little anger could sometimes just say, you know, that's my personal limit. I need you to
yes.
respect it. And
yes.
of course, the tale has to be dramatic. It has to show why that boundary can be so irritating if it's intruded upon. And so we have this violent action. Every one of these stories has one central, at least one central, weird and violent action, so that two things will happen. The first thing is we'll go, what the heck was that about? So we'll think about
it. It gets our attention, yes.
And it gets our attention, and we remember it. We remember
yes.
it. And that's why, really, these are healing tales. They're also teaching tales.
Yes. Now, what is a healing tale, really? I know at the outset of your book you talk about the characteristics of a healing tale. What do
yeah.
we look for in a healing tale?
Yes. A healing tale is perhaps most easily defined as it presents a problem that we encounter, that we have witnessed, if not actually lived through ourselves, and it suggests what is likely to happen if it is to resolve itself.
Yeah.
And so whether you have been hurt or somebody near you has been hurt, you're able to say, oh, I see what's happened, and this is going to be what will be required to get out of that space. Now, if I could give a particular example, there is a very odd story quite a way into the tales. It's tale number 41, I think. It's called Thousand Furs.
Uh-huh.
And in Thousand Furs, what happens is the young woman grows up without her mother. Her mother has died. And her father, who is a king, has incestuous thoughts towards her. Now, incestuous thoughts are not uncommon, even today. And she, this young woman, is completely horrified. So she runs away from home to escape this parental tyranny. But then she does something very interesting. She has this cloak, which she has persuaded her father to make for her, which is made of 1,000 different animal furs. And she wraps herself in it, and she hides in a tree, a hollow tree. And the people who find her think that she's some kind of wild animal at first, that she's so feral, so savage, and they say, well, you know, you can work cleaning up in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, before I tell you the whole story, you know, of course they had cases of incest and sexual exploitation
yeah.
in those days, just as we do today.
Yes.
And what the story shows is what happens to the individual. She, in this case, feels dirty, less than herself, degraded, and she takes on all of that aspect of wearing black, and she sits in the ashes. Ooh, doesn't that remind you of Cinderella, whose mother has also died and who has a negligent father? You know, she sits in the ashes, she's in mourning, and she cannot trust. And in the process of the tale unfolding, we see her beginning slowly, slowly to trust the king. He kind of works out that when the mysterious young woman appears at his birthday celebrations and then disappears, he works out, oh, I think I know who it is. But she drops little clues to let him pay attention so that he will look for her. And this is exactly what it takes when someone has been traumatized. They will drop little clues as to who they are to say, can I trust you? Are you going to keep my secret? Really? Are you? Can I trust? And they ask it again and again. And this is why I call this a healing tale, because it actually shows us what sorts of strategies, what sort of emotional support we can give those who've been deeply traumatized.
Yes.
And it says, you know, we can't just walk up to them and say, you can trust me, come on, cheer up. You know, that's not going to work. It's going to be a long process, and we have to let them approach us at their speed. Now, This is a long comparison, but I think any listener who has been following this will say, wait a second, this sounds an awful lot like Cinderella, because Cinderella sits in the ashes. That's why in the original version
yes.
it's called, the tale's called Ashputtel, you know, sitting there in the dirt. And she's mourning her lost and her dead mother. And so
yes,
she's degraded by the household. Yeah?
Yes, please tell us the tale of Cinderella in detail, because I think there is no tale that has had more influence on women. And I will mention, it's shown up a lot of ways. Before you launch into
yeah.
Cinderella, there was something I wanted to say about American women of my generation, which, you know, midlife. We grew up with this, the Rodgers and Hammerstein version of Cinderella,
yes.
which would come on every year. And there's kind of a cult around that version, which I didn't realize. But honestly, Alan, that had more effect on my life than a lot of things. I can remember every year looking forward to that version of Cinderella and all the songs, which ironically was kind of a mix. It wasn't as bad as the Disney version. It did have some empowerment in it. And it's not the real tale, but it's close. So I just feel like this tale has impacted us almost, I would say, even more than the Frog Prince, or, you know, or our belief in what the Frog Prince actually was, although in some ways both of them have impacted us. So I really want to give you the opportunity to tell us this tale. Right. We're going to enter into storytelling mode here from the beginning.
Well, thank you. It's a lovely story, and it's often presented in ways that are not very helpful to us. I mean, wonderful entertainment, Rodgers and Hammerstein, the Disney version, yes, great fun, but it sort of misses the point. In fact, in psychological terms, there is such a thing as the Cinderella syndrome, which has been referred to. And there are two versions of this. One of them is the syndrome where young women will hurt themselves and then report to the doctor that their parents are misusing them. That's fairly common, but it's not nearly as common as the other side of the Cinderella syndrome, which is young women feel they have to stay at home, sit by the phone or, you know, by the computer screen and wait for the men to contact them. And they repeat the mantra to themselves, someday my prince will come and save me.
Yeah.
And you know what? Both of these syndromes lead to a lot of very unhappy young women. And they're both not true. If you read the Grimm Brothers story, Cinderella is told, you know, she hears about this dance, it's called a wedding, that everyone is invited to because the prince is going to select his bride. And she says, okay, I want to go. And the sisters and the mother especially say, well, you can only go when you've sorted out all these peas and beans that I'm going to pour into the ashes. And so Cinderella sorts that lot out, with the help of some birds, which is an interesting sideline. Turtle doves, symbols of love, come and help her. And when she's done that, she says, can I go to the ball now, please? And the mother says, well, here's twice as many peas and beans, peas and lentils to sort out. Do that, and I'll let you go to the ball. She does. You know, she calls to the birds. The birds come and help her pick these things out. And she says, can I go to the ball now? This is the second time. And that's when the stepmother says, no, you're too dirty. You don't have any clothes. No, you can't. And that's when Cinderella, or Ashputtel as she's called, shows that she's got real courage, because she doesn't cave in. She just decides she's going to go. And she goes, as we know, three times to this ball. But before she does, she has to get some clothes. And here is the hint. What she does is she goes to her mother's grave, which she's been watering every day. She's been watering a hazel twig there, and it's grown into a tree. She goes to her mother's grave and says, you know, please make it possible for me to go to the ball. And the dresses she needs appear on this hazel tree, the small hazel tree, on each occasion. And at the end of each dance, she takes them back and returns them. Now, there's no fairy godmother. There's no...
Yes, it's interesting.
What we've got in the... Yeah, in the Grimm Brothers version, what we're asked to see is that what makes Ashputtel, Cinderella, what makes her strong enough to know that she has to be at this dance, what makes her know that she is lovable, is the love that she received from her mother before her mother died.
Yeah.
Psychologically, that's absolutely true. If a child knows that he or she has been loved as an infant, they can pretty much weather anything that the rest of the world throws at them.
Yes.
But if a child is abandoned or abused very early on in life, it becomes much more difficult for them to gain that self-confidence and self-awareness, that sense of worthiness that can power them into a successful life. Now, in Disney, it's all done by magic. The fairy godmother appears, here's your dress, here is your coach, no coach in the Grimm Brothers version, here is your footman, no footman in the Grimm Brothers version, and Cinderella goes off to the dance. Now, if we think of this in terms of, oh, somebody is going to make all my problems disappear, which is what the Disney version suggests, we're going to disempower ourselves. But if we look at the Grimm Brothers version, we have to think a little differently. And it may be something as simple as this. You know, when somebody is confident, when they feel worthy, when they know that there is a core of lovableness in them, which comes from those early experiences with a mother or a dedicated caregiver, when somebody knows that and they go out into the world, it doesn't matter what they're wearing, you can feel their inner beauty.
Yes.
So the dresses that Cinderella gets are just, as it were, the confirmation of the inner beauty. And in case we think this is pushing it too far, when she gets to the dance, the prince walks up to her and says, I will dance with her and no one else. And he does that on each of the three occasions. He sees right to the core of who she is. Of course, she's nicely dressed, and so she blends in with the other nicely dressed ladies. But he sees something, and maybe even more important is that when they dance together, what a lovely, lovely image that is, because if you dance with someone, ballroom dancing as it would be, some sort of ritualized dance, then you have to respond to the music and the beat and move in rhythm with the other person.
Yes.
We've all felt that. I'm sure we've all danced with people who are terrible dancers, and we go, oh, that was awful, you know, my poor feet. And we've all danced with people who just make us feel great. We go, wow, that was fun.
Yes, and in sync, yes.
Mm-hmm. In sync. So we have this sense of physical harmony that they experience when they dance, and also the sense that somehow the prince sees something in her. Now, I realize this is quite a long tale
We're doing actually very well on time. We have plenty of time. This is worth spending time. I'm listening in rapt attention, so keep going.
Oh, good. Well, I think it's worthwhile because...
Yes, it's very worthwhile.
Oh, good. Because, you know, the tale itself, this is one of the great tales. It's very rich. The tale doesn't say that Ashputtel and the prince danced and then he said, will you marry me? And she said, yes. You know, that would have been an easy answer. What happens is she leaves him on three separate occasions, which it strikes me as the action of somebody who is questioning, saying, well, okay, I've got this real attraction. Is it real? She comes back the second day. Is it real? She comes back the third day. And that, it strikes me, is part of the whole business of those who have been a little neglected, or even badly traumatized in their youth, moving forward and saying, okay, I think this is true. Am I sure? Am I really sure? Am I absolutely sure? And if she'd just been looking to get that wedding ring on her finger as fast as possible so she could get out of her horrible house, if that had been the case, she would have maneuvered him on the first occasion into saying something rash, and that would have been the end of the story. But by moving towards him three times, when she runs away, and it's interesting, she doesn't run away at midnight, she runs away as it gets dark. She runs away at the point when romance and romantic delusions, you know, soft lights, nice music, when they could perhaps be too persuasive. She runs away just as it gets dark, and he actually pursues her three times in the Grimm Brothers tale. The first time she runs into a dovecot, like a bird going to roost, and he pursues her, but she escapes. The second time she goes up a tree, again like a bird, he pursues her, but she escapes. The third time she also escapes, but he gets her slipper, because he smeared the stairs with pitch. So her running away gives him the chance to say, I really want this woman. I really want this woman. My goodness, I've got to do something to get this woman.
Yes.
And then once he's got the slipper, of course, in the story that we know so well, he just has to turn up and she slips it on her foot, etc., etc. In the Grimm Brothers version, he goes to see the house where he thinks she lives. And the eldest daughter says, oh, you know, it must be me he's looking for, but my feet are too big. And so her mother says, take this knife and cut your toes off. And then your foot will slip into the... Yeah, I mean, talk about cosmetic surgery, as I say to people. Brutal, brutal stuff. Cripple yourself in order to marry the prince.
Yes.
And the prince, God bless him, realizes, you know, oh, I've promised to marry whoever fits into this shoe. Oh, I wasn't expecting this. But he keeps his word. But as they're riding back, the blood, of course, is flowing from the sister's shoes, and the doves come along and say, the doves are there again, sort of heavenly symbols of love and peace. And the doves come along and say to the prince, you got the wrong girl. And he drives back and says, is there anyone else? He rides back, and the second sister says, yes, it must be me. And she takes the same knife and cuts her heel off, also crippling herself.
Yeah.
And the same thing happens. They wander off, and I mean, you can see why somebody might think this is not suitable for children, you know, body parts being removed in this way. The prince sees the blood dripping down, says, can't be this one. He goes back and says, there's got to be someone else in this house I can try this slipper on. There's got to be someone else. Notice how insistent he is. He's not some wimpy chap wandering around saying, oh, I don't know where she is. And Cinderella, Ashputtel's father, comes out with this astonishing line. He says, well, there is just the kitchen drudge that my wife left to me when she died.
Oh, my.
Yeah, talk about degrading.
I don't
remember
that part. That's as degrading as it gets.
About as degrading as it gets. And interestingly, Disney removes father from the equation altogether. He's not there.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. But this one, he's obviously a father who just really doesn't care for this daughter at all, and has forgotten about her. And he's kind of loathsome, actually. And that's when the prince says, I've got to see her. She emerges. Unlike the Disney version, she's not all scrubbed and bright and blonde and lovely. Of course, she's covered in ashes. She's filthy, which is
herself.
You would be if you were a kitchen. Yeah, she's herself.
And
takes the slipper, slips it on her, and he doesn't have any hesitation at all. He says, and I quote, this is the true bride.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what she's wearing, doesn't matter if she's covered in ash, he says, this is the one, I know it's the one. Now, what courage does that take? He's a prince, and she's the lowest of the lowly servants, and he's going to take her back home and say, Dad, I want to marry this one. Yes, he is. Do you see how that changes the dynamic? We have an empowered woman who allows because of her actions, because of not letting herself be ground down. She allows the man who is going to marry her to become empowered as well. She goes forward three times, he comes forward three times, and then a fourth time when he puts the slipper on her foot. Now, that's a very, very different diagram. Cinderella does not stay at home and weep and say, someday my prince will come. She goes out and she finds him. And she makes jolly sure that she wants him before he turns up again. And it's a completely different story. And I think, really, the completely different story, and I say this to my classes at Curry College because they're usually aged about 20, and I see these young women nodding their heads and say, yep, yep, that's a better story than the one we were brought up with, yep. And I think,
certainly more powerful,
yes, you're right there.
yes. I mean, the stories we've been brought up with are so simplistic. I mean, there's really nothing to them. When you begin to see the depth of the real stories, and there's no comparison. It's true.
I was just going to say that all of these Grimm Brothers tales, they're very, very short. A long Grimm Brothers tale is about 5 pages.
Yeah.
So there's an awful lot that's concentrated into these very brief stories. And, of course, they would have been repeated. People would have repeated them round the fire at night in the winter. Like now, they'd have said, let's hear the story of Ashputtel. And that would have reinforced the ability to think differently about, what is it that Ashputtel does? What is it the prince does? What does it mean?
Yes.
And they would have been available to think about this a great deal. Our problem today is that there are a gazillion stories available on the TV anytime we wish to press the button. And some of those stories are very attractive, and some of them are absolute garbage.
Yes.
But the Grimm Brothers selected their tales and said, these are the powerful ones that for generations people have said, this has got true good stuff in it. We want this one. Because people don't listen to stories if they don't have any topical relevance. And if it's topically relevant for year upon year and generation upon generation, you can be pretty sure it's talking straight to the heart. So these are heart-based stories. And I, for one, think that in our world we have plenty of stories, some of which are heart-based, but many of them get lost in the shuffle of what this year's sitcom is, what's going to win the award for the best series, etc., etc., etc. It gets lost. And that's why I think we need to read the Grimm Brothers tales and read them sensitively whenever we can.
Yes. You know, something that you're really making me reflect upon is how these tales, we really have lost something, because it used to be you didn't have to be an intellectual or even literate to hear these tales, because they were told again and again around the fire.
Yeah.
Our popular entertainment has essentially eviscerated meaning in what is shared in the popular culture. It is that seems, not to say there aren't deep tales told that get out there every once in a while, but I find this very sad, and that we've lost something. And you're reminding us of this, and I don't know how we get it back, within not just those of us listening to a show like this, but our society really gets back that search for core meaning that's approachable. That's the thing, is these tales were approachable. They weren't hidden. They were there. They were right in front of people.
Yes, very approachable, very short, and very popular. As traveling storytellers would go from village to village, and they'd come back, every 4-6 months or whatever, and they would be welcomed, and then they would tell these stories. Sometimes I think that if you were a German peasant, you would have had only one book, and that would have been the Bible. And the Bible would have told you, in some ways, how to deal with the divine. But the Grimm Brothers tales would also tell you how to deal with the all-too-human business of in Ashputtel's case, growing up and finding a mate and making sure you get a good one. So this was essential for them. Today, as you say, we have lots of tales. Many of them have eviscerated any good meaning that may have been in them. And in some ways, this has always been the province of education, that within what used to be thought of as the body of education, there would be tales, you know, the canon, as we might call it, the great stories. There would be stories that everybody, at least everybody in authority, agreed, oh, this is a good one, we should be talking about this, we should we should know this. But actually that hasn't been the case now for a long, long time. I think, you know, there are some truly great stories that came out in the 19th and 20th century, which were extraordinary. But in some ways, we're now deluged with all sorts of other things. If we look, for instance, at the, I hope it's now almost past, but the prevalence of stories about vampires and werewolves and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
You know, which teenagers lap up. I exclude Harry Potter from this because I think Harry Potter does something different in a more intelligent way. But many of my my students, they read things like the Twilight Trilogy, and they say, ugh, I hate this heroine because all she does is be weak and get rescued. And others say, oh, I really like that. And I'm saying to myself, huge books that have sold, whatever it is, 400 million copies. And who's reading Grimm today? Who's reading those old tales? So I think part of the job of education is not just to get people to pass standardized tests and to check the boxes to get a percentile that will make the school district look good. I think education, and especially literature in education, is about asking people to think about their human values. What is it that you value? What does matter? Do you really want to have a successful and a happy life with a life partner? Or, you know, if you don't like that, the alternative is you can make a lot of money and you can have a succession of partners for portions of your life, which seems to be something that happens to a lot of people. Why can't we bring the heart back to education, which is to say, look, you're coming to school to learn some skills, and some of those skills may also involve thinking about who you are and how you want your life to run, instead of which we talk about success and people getting jobs and people having work skills. I'm saying, what about life skills that will help them to bring up their children? What about life skills that will help them to treat their spouse better? What about skills that will treat them, that will allow them to be good neighbors to each other without just being walked all over by whosoever happens to live next door in the community? Those are skills too. And that's what the Grimm brothers, when they collected these tales, that's what they found echoed over and over again. How do you deal with people who are selfish and destructive? Oh, there is a way. You recognize it and you decide not to go that way. That's why the stepsisters are crippled. It's interesting in the original Grimm's version that it spelled out that the stepsisters were not ugly. They were beautiful, we're told, but they had black hearts. They were selfish. So you can see this whole story of Cinderella Ashputtel as that fight between living a productive life and living a selfish life that is just going to be about position, marrying the right trophy husband, and cheating your way to the top. Both are possible ways forward. But Ashputtel manages to get her way to the top by simply being herself and by mobilizing her courage and her own sense of self-worth. You know, that's a really powerful story.
Yes, definitely. What does Cinderella, and I know we're at risk of spending a lot of time on Cinderella, but that's okay. This is an important tale, and we will have time for some others, I think. What does it have to say about soulmates? Because I know that you've explored that, and you have a very popular YouTube video out there on soulmates, and this sense of knowing that they have. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Oh, yes. Well, as we remember from the story, as I just described it, Cinderella Ashputtel knows she has to be at this ball.
Yes.
She doesn't quite know why. She just knows. She's not going to be deflected. And she calls on the help of the birds to sort out those lentils and peas. And so she is connected in every way to what is natural and growthful and, you might say, absolutely normal. She's not connected to anything artificial. And when she turns up at the dance, the prince, for whatever reasons we can surmise perhaps a number of things, but he says, I will dance with this woman and no other. And I think that when soulmates meet, they do recognize something. They can't always spell out what it is they recognize, but they go, oh, yes. Something about this person feels vital for me to know. And that's why we had that symbolism of the dance, because they are evenly matched. They are able to respond to each other in a way that is physical and emotional and in every other way, you might say. They just have this deep, powerful recognition. And I think that's what happens when soulmates meet. And the trouble is that they can't meet unless they mobilize themselves to get to the place where they can be. And poor old Ashputtel could still be sitting by the fire.
You know, I have to say the most popular song of the 1965 Cinderella special that stays in my head my entire life, I swear, is In My Own Little Corner in My Own Little Chair. Where she's, sitting. Now, the next part of that is, I can be whatever it is I want to be, or something like that. But she's still sitting in the corner. She can only imagine that she's this thing. And so then she imagines being all these things, and yet she's just sitting there in the corner. And until the fairy godmother comes along in that particular version, which I tell you has ingrained itself in the psyches of women who watched it every year, I can guarantee it. We share in this cult of that 60s special, which I found out on YouTube. Everybody's following it there. You know, the fairy godmother had to come and deliver her, essentially. But it's just what you say is so important, that it takes courage and love for oneself. You know, she was very courageous to go out. You know, we think we have to be perfectly dressed, or, you know, you have to look a certain way. This comes out in your soulmate video too, that, you know, people aren't always, I mean, they're not going to be perfect, and they go out very imperfectly, and yet they still go out courageously, which is the point.
Yes, I think that's exactly it. If this story is there to teach us anything, one of the things it must be praised for is it teaches young women courage.
Yes.
That's not something we routinely do. Teach young women to be independent and courageous and just know that they're okay.
Yes, yes.
A marvelous, marvelous lesson right there.
Now, I know that we may be almost taking on too much if I do this, but dare I ask how the archetypes reflect themselves in the story? Just giving a very brief definition of the archetypes, because we can't get into it in too much detail.
We can't, I'm afraid. We don't have time, but I'll do my best. The archetypes, for those of your listeners who haven't heard my other broadcast, the archetypes are six stages that exist that we are invited on life's journey to go through. And not everybody wants to go through all of the six stages of personal development that the archetypes offer us. but they're there. And what's more important is that all of the great literature since Western literature began, all of the great literature has these same six archetypes, always the same six, always in the same order, always dealing with the same things. So if we use Cinderella as an example, we might say she starts as a child, as a baby, innocent. She is the archetypal innocent. She can't do very much, except we discover she has this tremendous ability to love and trust her mother who dies. But she loves the memory, she tends the grave, so she is someone who has this powerful ability to love and trust. And that is going to be necessary through all the other stages. Now, when her mother dies, she transitions to the next stage, which is that of the orphan. And the orphan happens to all of us. We all find ourselves feeling a bit lost, cast out, misunderstood, no friends. And she spends time in that space, literally in the ashes, mourning, her mother's death and her own situation. But she knows there's something else. And that's what happens when news of the dance comes along. She perks up and says, I have to be there. I have to go. When we are orphans, we stay put in whatever situation we're in because we can't think of anything else. But at a certain point, we transition to the third stage, pilgrim. And as pilgrims, we say, I'm going to find out what matters. And so Cinderella, Ashputtel, goes out to the ball, and she encounters the prince, and she realizes, wait a second, this might be a person who is worth being with. And when she makes that decision, she transitions from a pilgrim, the wanderer, the seeker after truth, to the fourth archetype. And that fourth archetype is the warrior lover, where she has to take action and do so compassionately. And that's what she does, I think, after she's met the prince, and indeed when she goes back to her home and waits to see what would happen. It's as though she said, I've done my bit, I've shown where my heart and feelings lie, now let's see what happens. Tremendous risk, of course, because you've got no guarantee the other person is strong enough to reciprocate. But he is, which shows that he is at that same level as well. He's been looking as a pilgrim for his bride. He thinks he's found her. Now he has to go and track her down. And when he finds her, he says, this is the true bride. And she agrees. She doesn't contradict. She doesn't say, you know, are you sure? She doesn't say, well, you know, just let me fix my hair up a bit. She says nothing. In other words,
that would be her
sister. I am the true bride.
Yes.
When we get to that fourth stage where we've found literally our other half, our life purpose, what we're supposed to be doing, that's when we transition to the monarch level, which is what the prince will be. One day he'll be king. One day Ashputtel will be queen. And as such, they will have fought for what they believe, and they'll be in a position to mobilize the rest of the kingdom to follow their example and fought and fight for what they believe, too. And when that happens, the monarch, the fifth stage, is very close to transitioning to the sixth archetype, the magician. Because the magician doesn't actually tell people what to do so much as allows them to change their energy so that they can do what they're supposed to do. And that's what a really great ruler does. A really great ruler doesn't give a lot of orders. A really great ruler says, you know what you have to do. Are you going to do it? And suddenly it's not, oh, I'm doing this because I'm told. It's a case of, ooh, I'm doing this because I believe it's the best way forward. And that's magic. That's the team coach who brings out of the players a performance on the field that is better than they knew they were capable of. That's the inspired leader who makes sure that all those he is working with are not sitting around going, oh, I don't like this, but they are motivated, and so they work much more effectively. So those are the six archetypes, and I think the story, as it were, functions to give us the progress of Cinderella through these six stages until we see, as we read the story, that she is an inspiration to us, that she and her husband are now the magicians who say, it's okay to look for what you really, really think you deserve and want. And it's not okay to sit in the ashes passively. So you may say the six archetypes are present in this story, and actually in many of the Grimm Brothers stories. Some of them aren't such great stories, but most of the big ones, most of the ones that stay in our imaginations, they share these six archetypes with the greatest literature the West has ever known.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty convincing way of saying these ultra-short stories have got the real goods. This is real literature, even though it may look like it's something that you're only going to talk to your children about until the age of five. No, there are deep, important things here. So that's a very quick rundown of the six archetypes.
Beautifully done. I think it was reflected very well within the story of Cinderella. And I'm going to do something I don't always do, but I'm going to do it today because we are surfacing fairly high among the live shows on Blog Talk Radio, and I'm thankful to Blog Talk Radio for that on the live page. You are listening to The Frontier Beyond Fear. I'm host Susan Laris and Danz, and we are talking today with Dr. Alan G. Hunter about the power of fairy tales, most specifically the power of the Grimm Brothers tales and what they can teach us about psychological insights into life. And Alan has a PhD in English literature from Oxford University, and he's the author of 12 books, and he's come to this show many times, and I invite you to listen to past episodes. And if you're just joining us now, I very much invite you to go to the beginning of the podcast when it's finished, because he's been sharing some really powerful things. So, and once again, I'm thankful to you, Alan, for being here today and welcoming the live audience here with us.
Oh, I'm very grateful to be on your show, Susan, and thank you so much for including me. It's been such a pleasure.
Yes, well, we have a half an hour left, so
okay.
We're going to keep exploring these tales. Now, something that you brought up just in the last half hour, which I think is worthy of mentioning again, is that I really do believe, Alan, we have lost sight in many cases of how literature and tales like these, they really teach life skills. And I will tell this to you from the standpoint of a mother of a teenager, in that you'll hear sometimes in the school districts of, oh, we need more life skills training, you know, and they want to make this into some kind of course, you know, what are the meaningful life skills. And a lot of times they'll have a course on various things, you know, being a decent human being, and they tend to be not real popular courses unless they require them, or the kids who take them have to be the, you know, the ones who they feel really need those courses. You know, they're not all the kids will take them. And yet, what you really bring forward is that we are losing sight of the value of our English courses in the schools, because it's not just learning to write, which is important. I often hear that as justification. Our kids need to learn to write and to read. It's what's behind both the reading and the writing. When I read my son's essays, I see him reflecting on values. And you bring that forward, and we need to consciously be aware of this within our school districts and as parents, and ask for this, that this is what I see. And even as we go forward into higher education, there's value, great value, which I know you very much believe in.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear you say that, because and that was why I wrote the book, or that's actually why I've written several of my books, because I think higher education often is well-intentioned, but often is designed by people who don't see what is, in fact, right in front of us as a valuable resource. And that's a great loss if we can't use it.
Yes, yes, very much so. So, All right. Well, now that we've explored some fairly well-known tales, actually, I'm going to give you the opportunity to select another tale to talk to us about, because there's so many to choose from, and I think perhaps, and if you won't pick one, I will, but I invite you to talk.
Well, perhaps I should defer to you.
Than usual. Oh, here we go.
which tale were you thinking of particularly?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's Faithful John. That's fairly complex.
Yeah.
You were just talking about leadership. And actually, there's quite a bit in Faithful John about children as a parent.
Yep.
And I know we have a lot of parents listening this time of day. So that might be one that would be worth spending some time on?
Well, I can certainly do that. Faithful John is one of the ones right at the start of the collection, but for some reason people don't know it terribly well, which is a great pity. So perhaps I'll start off by telling the story about poor old Faithful Johannes, as he's called, Faithful John, because Faithful John is... he's the servant to a king who is dying. And the king who is dying says, you know, I want you to look after my son when he takes over the kingdom, and do everything you can to stop him seeing the portrait that's in the locked room. And you think, ooh, a portrait in a locked room. So the old king dies, and the young king says to Faithful Johannes, show me what I've inherited. And Faithful Johannes shows him everything in the palace except the locked room. And the young king says, well, what about this door? You keep going past it. And Johannes says, well, I promised your dad that you shouldn't go in there. And the young king says, I'm king now. Let me see what's in there. And so Faithful Johannes opens the door and tries to stand in front of this portrait because he knows what will happen. The young king walks in, sees the portrait of the Princess of the Golden Roof, as she's called, and he takes one look, and he falls down in an absolute dead faint, just as his father had predicted. And when he comes to, he says, she's the one, I've got to marry her, you've got to help me. And Faithful Johannes is faithful, so he says, okay, you're my king, this is what we have to do. And what they do is rather peculiar. So here is this young man who is struck down with love, with loving devotion for someone he hasn't met yet. But you might say something about this person moves him so much that he says, I need real love in my life. I'm going to find it. So Faithful Johannes and he set off to the kingdom, or the queendom of the Princess of the Golden Roof. And they take with them, some tales say, all the gold, other tales say, all the gold that is in the treasury made into beautiful sculptural objects because they have heard that the princess loves gold and loves golden things.
Yeah.
Now, we could jump to a conclusion and say, oh, well, she's materialistic. Well, we could realize that gold at that time was a symbol of eternity because it doesn't rust. Everything else sort of rotted and rusted. In the 18th century, everything was in the process of falling to pieces shortly after it was made. But gold endured. So whatever else this princess is, she's linked to purity of feeling and perhaps purity of love. So they go off to find the princess on a boat, and Johannes walks up to the palace, and he meets a serving woman who is carrying water in solid gold buckets. So he knows he's in a different world than ours, and he says to her, I want to meet the princess, and the serving woman says, oh yeah, follow me. The princess goes down to the boat to where the objects are and is absolutely delighted with them, and whilst she's admiring them, the crew slip the cables and set off out to sea. So this is already looking a bit like a kidnapping.
Yes.
But we have to hold our breaths here for a moment, because What then happens is the princess says, you've kidnapped me, oh, this is terrible, and you're a merchant, oh, that's awful. Whereupon the young king says, well, actually, I'm a king, and I did this for a reason. And she's very quickly won over and agrees to marry him. Now, obviously, this isn't realistic. Who would want to marry their abductor? Unless we look at this and say, well, look, here he is. He's a man who's prepared to venture everything he has for this feeling that he feels. He goes to meet her. He knows that it has to be her. And, you know, he's not holding back emotionally or monetarily. And she respects that. And suddenly it's a case of, oh, really? You did all this for me? Okay, you're more impressive than I... And she agrees to marry him. So we could look at it as an abduction, in which case, you know, we don't have a story. Or we could look at it symbolically that the young king says, whatever it is I'm feeling, I must act on it. Don't get in my way. I'll invest everything I have. It's that powerful, intuitive sense. The same sort of thing we saw with the prince in Ashputtel. If we look at it that way, the next part of the story, because it could end right there with, you know, and they all lived happily ever after. But the next part of the story gets kind of interesting.
Yes,
because
it does.
Johannes is sitting on the boat's deck, and he hears some ravens talking, and the ravens say, when the prince reaches land, when the young king, I should say, reaches land, he'll see a horse. He must not ride it. It will carry him away, and you'll never see him again. Okay. The second raven says, when the young king starts to get the marriage ceremony going, he'll see his wedding clothes. You know, he must not wear them because they will scorch him to death, but nobody's going to help him. And the third raven says, well, you know, it's worse than that because when they're dancing, the king and the queen have their first dance together, the queen will swoon and she will die unless somebody bites her right breast, sucks out 3 drops of blood and spits them on the ground. Now, this is very peculiar. I think you'll have to agree.
Yes, and might I interject that for people who missed the beginning of this conversation, it's these tales can contain a lot of jarring imagery at times, and yet it's the insights below that are meaningful, and it may be why they've been hidden from us in some ways. That, you know,
well,
and yet
so.
We tell many other jarring tales in our society, which is interesting. I mean, there are many popularized tales that are violent, and yet you know, these have enduring meaning. So anyway, continue.
Yeah.
I hope I haven't put you on too long of a venture here.
No, well, it's a long venture, but if we look at some of the Hollywood stories that have a male lead and a female lead who find themselves against their will engaged in an adventure, who then decide by, you know, a third of the way through the movie that they find each other really attractive, we'll have to say the same formula is available to us today. And then they both go through a number of tests, which is exactly what the ravens are talking about. When the young king gets to his kingdom, he sees the horse. Johannes runs up to it and kills it. And the young king, because he trusts faithful Johannes, says, okay, don't understand it, but I trust him. When he sees his wedding clothes, he's about to put them on, Johannes grabs them and throws them in the fire, and the young king says, okay, Johannes has always been a faithful servant. I don't know why he did that, but I'll accept it. Because Johannes has been told that if he ever says anything about this, he will be turned to stone. So then finally, the young couple are dancing, and the queen falls down in a faint, a swoon, as is predicted, and faithful Johannes knows what he has to do. Remember, he can't tell anyone about it. So he rips open the front of her dress, bites her right breast, and spits out 3 drops of blood, which saves her life. But the young king is enraged. He can forgive the horse. he can forgive the clothing, but it looks as though the old man is trying to encroach on sexual boundaries
that
he should
that
not
would
be
not
encroaching
look,
on.
Look proper.
Yeah. So he condemns the old man to death because he doesn't understand. And before Johannes is to be burned to death, he says, this is why I did it. You know, the ravens told me there were three tests I had to save you from. I've done it. But now I know that because I've spoken about it, I will be turned into stone. And he is.
Yes.
And the young king says, oh, you know, I doubted him. How could I do that? I doubted him because I was proud, because I was full of my own sexual longings. He's just got married. And all I could see was jealousy.
Yes.
So the young king takes, this is a very odd bit, he takes
go ahead.
Yeah, it is peculiar, isn't it?
It is an odd tale.
The stone, the turned to stone image of Johannes, he takes it and he puts it in his bedroom and, to remind him, presumably, that he should trust. Now, I don't know what people like to have as ornaments in their bedrooms, but I think, you know, the mummified image of your former father substitute is a pretty peculiar one.
Yes, that would be.
And yet, it would be. And yet, it's all about, this story is all about how sometimes we listen to the advice our parents give us, and sometimes we don't listen to them. And when we stop listening to them, when we doubt this good advice, if it comes from faithful Johannes, it is good advice. If we stop listening to them, we effectively turn our relatives into stone. They cannot contribute to our lives anymore. Every parent knows this. Every parent knows that there are some things that if you ask the child about, they get really annoyed. Especially things that are personal, like, you know, have you been out on any dates recently? What business is that of yours? You know, that sort of shut down comment that often happens when there is a lack of trust. And so faithful Johannes has throughout the story been the faithful servant to a young king as he grows up, and then the young king shuts him down because he thinks he knows best.
Yeah.
And that's when the young king goes into mourning. He says, oh, if only there was a way to get faithful Johannes back. And then the statue says, yes, there is, actually, but you must sacrifice the things you love most to get me back. And the things he loves most are his twin boys. The statue says, cut their heads off. Wow, think of that. Cut their heads off, smear me with the blood, and I will come back to life.
You know,
the young
king
does.
It sounds somewhat biblical, actually. I mean,
it really is, isn't it?
And again, this is so symbolic, is that what this is going to ultimately mean in terms of parenting. So keep going.
Yeah. Well, it's very much Abraham and Isaac, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, Abraham is told to sacrifice Isaac, and then at the last minute, a ram appears that he sacrifices instead. Very reminiscent, because this is the ultimate test. The ultimate test is this young king going to take the advice of the old man without question? And the young king says, got to do it. So he takes the heads off his young sons, smears the statue comes to life. Its first action is to put the boys' heads back on, and they are totally unharmed and act as if nothing has happened. And then the queen comes home, and the young king hides faithful Johannes and hides the boys and says, what would you do if I told you we had to cut our sons' heads off to get faithful Johannes back? And the queen says, we'd have to do it. Notice how she is totally loyal to him. She doesn't question, she doesn't second guess, she doesn't argue, she just says, faithfulness, faithful Johannes, loyalty is above everything else. Doing the right thing is more important, even as far as she's concerned, than any sort of, please look after my children type stuff. Well, you know, I love children. I have
yes.
children and grandchildren, and I don't advocate cutting their heads off.
No,
but this is a
no,
metaphor.
Generally not.
No, generally not. But this is a metaphor which says,
yes.
Are you prepared if something happens and you have to be stern with your children?
Yes.
Are you prepared to do it? Are you prepared to say to the child who is turning perhaps to crime or whatever, to say, if you carry on down this road, there are going to be severe consequences for our relationship. Do you understand that? Are we, as a colleague had to some years ago with his son, who was abusing drugs and was heavily addicted, are we prepared to say, you know what, son, you may hate me forever for doing this, but I'm going to make sure you get the rehab treatment that you need, even if you never talk to me again?
Yeah.
Now, that's a different way of putting it. And often I see around me parents who want to be so nice to their children and spoil them, and they give them everything and so on, and you know what? They wind up with children who despise them.
Yes.
Whereas sometimes
isn't that amazing?
That whole
because they think they're being their child's best friend, and yet it ends up being the opposite, which it,
exactly.
It's interesting.
They try to buy goodwill as opposed to
yes.
doing what a parent has to do, and sometimes tough love is a very necessary part of being a parent.
Yes.
Sometimes we just have to say, that's not okay. You cannot
yes.
do that. You know, you cannot invite 200 of your friends to the house when I'm out of town for the weekend and have a wild party. You cannot do that and expect
yes.
to maintain the relationship that we have.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And yet, how many parents seem to say, oh, well, you know, it's just kids being kids, blah, blah, blah. Different parenting styles, but the Grimm brothers yet again talk about fathers advising young and headstrong young men, and those young men then discovering that they need a bit of that paternal advice when they have their own children. And if they've shut their parents out, they have to try and make peace and say, you know, I know we fell out over this, I know you didn't like what I did, but right now I need your help. Will you come back into the family? And at that point, of course, parents are likely to say, sure, I'll come back if you'll listen to what I have to say.
Yes.
And that can be very hard, as hard
That's
as,
true.
You know, anything. So a very long story, beautifully compressed story, but right there, it tells us something. The Grimm brothers allow us to see something that is at the heart of every family, and that is, how do we take advice? What do we do if we don't like the advice that we're getting, if we don't understand it, how we shut down parents, and how we may want that advice back in our lives at some point, in which case, if we really want it, then we have to take it. We have to take that advice. My goodness, I mean, psychologists have written volumes on parenting, huge volumes. Every year new ones come out, and sometimes I think, you know, they could read Faithful Johannes, and they would probably get a few good insights out of that, too.
Yes, yes. Yes, you know, in a way, I was almost afraid I picked one that was too long, and yet it's a perfect example really interesting way of why what may seem an unlikely tale, even with some rather jarring elements, brings forward these important truths. And you know, we can't lose sight of parenting. I mean, it really, I mean, I cannot overemphasize how important it is in our society today and has always been. And I feel like I'm glad that we covered this because we, again, those of you who are listening live, please do go back to the beginning of this podcast because we've really covered a lot of ground today, and I invite you to do that. And I think the most important thing here, Alan, is how you've brought forth the power of metaphor and how we've lost sight of that in many ways because we've made all of our stories way too shallow such that, you know, there just isn't much we can draw from them anymore.
Well, I tend to think that that is the case. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of stories out there, and not all of them are shallow. Some of them, I think, are probably as good as anything. But there is an awful lot that we read about. I mean, we look at the New York Times bestseller list or whatever, and everyone's jumping up and down and saying, this is the greatest story you've ever seen, and a year later, nobody remembers it. Nobody's reading it. Perhaps it wasn't as important as we thought. So the old tales, the time-tested tales, sometimes can let us know, if, for want of a better word, the classics. Sometimes those classics let us know there is something enduring here which worked for generations upon generations upon generations. Perhaps we can gain something from it as well.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I think when I talk about all of our stories, I'm thinking about the literal sitting around the fire kind of stories, which, you know, nowadays that's going to be the television. And sure, there are good stories on television. I don't want to diminish it completely. There are wonderful movies. And yet we've lost sight of something here. And I feel that you've really helped to bring that out today. And we are running out of time rapidly, as often happens. So I want to give you the opportunity to let people know where to learn more about you, Alan.
Yes, certainly. My website is Alan Hunter, that's A-L-L-A-N, Hunter.net, where you'll find many pages devoted to the archetypes, and you'll find links to all my books, especially this one, Princes, Frogs, and Ugly Sisters. I'm on Facebook as Dr. Alan Hunter, and I have a YouTube channel, which is Dr. Alan Hunter, Dr. Alan Hunter, where you can find some of my videos in which I talk about these things and other things. So I'm fairly easily found.
Yes, yes. And there are a lot of Alan Hunters out there, so I've
there
noticed
are.
That searching for Alan G. Hunter is very effective. That seems to isolate the results pretty well.
Yes, well, thank you for saying that, because there are.
Yes, yes, and yeah, that's what I recommend. If you do a search out there, enter Alan G. Hunter, and, you know, let me say once again, and one of the topics we've covered more than once is gratitude, and I certainly invite listeners to discover the archive of your shows, which is out there on frontierbeyondfear.com. Because we've covered so many profound topics, because you've written just such a wonderful wealth of material, Alan, on how to live our lives. So, but let me say once again, thank you so much for your presence on this show in the last year. Thank you so much, and I look forward to more.
Oh, thank you, Susan. From my heart, thank you, because it has been such a pleasure to have these conversations and to talk about things that are very close to my heart and my soul. So thank you. The gratitude is mine.
Well, you are very much appreciated here. And I think perhaps next time we'll have to talk about looking at Write Your Memoir, although I'm going to have to do some work with that book before we... I actually have homework for the next show, and
yes,
I honestly invite other people. Here's a challenge to issue to the live audience listening today is if you've thought about writing a memoir or writing about your life, if you don't even think that you want to write a memoir and don't even know what one is, go check out Alan Hunter's book, Write Your Memoir, and we will be talking about that, I hope. I think that's the topic for our next show. And pay attention to frontierbeyondfear.com for the schedule as to when we will schedule that. So I would love to talk about that with you, Alan.
I would be delighted, yes. Yes, a rich topic of human development right there. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you again. And I look forward for till next time. And before the show goes down live, I'm going to just let people know next week I'm taking just a little bit of a break after a very busy week of shows this week. But we do have a show next Friday, March 7th at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. Edie Summers is coming on. She's been on before. She's a local Portland health and wellness coach and also a radio host herself on Blog Talk Radio with quite a growing program in the self-help category. And we're going to talk about a book that she put out called Self-Coach Your Way to More Energy. And I'm looking forward to that because Edie and I have talked a lot about yoga and different things that we can do. She's a nutritional coach as well, so I think she will be very helpful coming on the broadcast next Friday at 1 p.m. Pacific. FrontierBeyondFear.com is where to go for all the information on this program. Thank you so much for being here today to the live audience. A welcome to the podcast audience as well. Thank you so much. I so appreciate the community around this show and the wonderful guests who are coming our way. And I love that we're getting more recurring guests because that's when we really get to explore the depths of someone's work. And I am so appreciative of that. So thank you again, everyone, for being here. And I look forward to seeing you next time. Take care. Thank you.